Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It is 5 o'clock. Can you please turn off your cell phones or pagers or anything else that would make noise? Today we have Senator Giesel, myself, Senator Dunleavy, and we should be, Senator Ellis should be here hopefully here in a little while. Is Danith here somewhere?
No, she's right here.
Okay. So today we're going to talk about the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. That would be Larry Dietrich. Larry, come on up. Larry, please state your name for the record and then give your overview, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich, Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And we're here today, I believe, to do the budget overview.
That is correct. Thank you.
Okay, if we're all ready to go, then you should have a slide printout, and we'll start with that. It's a PowerPoint on hard copy.
Division of Spill Prevention Response, SPAR.
There it is. There.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And as noted by the agenda, Mr. Chairman, it'll be two parts. So part one here will go through the division budget and our expenditures and operating costs and whatnot. And we'll get through those program reviews. And then when that's done, the second item then will be to go through the response fund.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a separate one-page pass-out that's a color schematic of the refund. So we'll deal with all the response fund questions then at the end, if that's okay.
Okay.
And the other document is the purple book. And as we go through, I can make reference then to the page numbers anytime that as we discuss the slides, so we can make reference if you want to go back or forth or not. So.
Fine.
Okay.
Okay. All right, sir.
All righty. Well, we'll go ahead and start then. Turning to page two then, we start out with the mission of the division, which is to protect public safety, health, and the environment through prevention, preparedness, and cleanup of oil and hazardous substances. That's the mission for our division. On page three, then, is an outline of our core services. These are executed essentially through three programs within the division. The first is the Contaminated Site Program, which oversees and conducts cleanups at contaminated sites in the state of Alaska. The second program, which is a component in the budget as well, is the industry preparedness component, which ensures that producers, transporters, and distributors of crude oil and refined oil are prepared financially and have spill plans in place to be able to respond to a spill. They're essentially, this is part of our regulated arm, and I will show you when we get to the program reviews, then that parts of industry that are regulated by this program. The third component that we'll be discussing is our emergency response program. And this is the group that actually conducts response to oil and hazardous substance releases in the state of Alaska on a 24/7 basis. And it's their job then to respond and oversee and ensure the cleanup or take over the cleanup if the RP responsible party is not able to do so. They also do all the government planning and preparedness that's necessary. The fourth group, which is a very small group in the division, is simply the group that manages the response fund. They administer the prevention and response accounts. So what I will do is I'll proceed through the budget document consistent with the purple thing then. The next one then will be to give you, we'll proceed by going through the programs. So turning to page four, right before we start that, just a quick word about our leadership in our division. We essentially have myself and four program managers then, one that leads each of those four programs. We've got a combined total of 159 years of experience. We've got a very diverse group of people that are from Alaska. Our program is technically complex in a lot of different areas, so we've got engineers, environmental specialists, and technicians that carry out the work. We've got a number of specialized degrees and specialized training to do it. We're involved in a pretty wide array of industry activities, including the federal government and federal government cleanups. We participate on the Arctic Council. We participated with a Pacific Northwest Economic Region. We participate on a Pacific States BC Oil Spill Task Force, which is the Pacific Coast States. We were on the review, U.S. Coast Guard review team for the Gulf of Mexico spill. We're involved with the aging infrastructure issues associated with our oil industry in Alaska, new contaminants, and we've got quite a backlog of what we call legacy contaminated sites in Alaska, dating all the way back to World War II. Turning to page five then, this is a thumbnail of our operating budget by fund source. And as we go through each of the programs here, I can just kind of categorically deal with the budget issues up front here. And so to summarize, there are no organizational changes. We have no amendments, no supplementals, no increments, no transfers, and no new positions for proposed for FY14. And we'll flag that as we go through. So it's a strictly baseline budget for us. The funding sources on page five then, looking at the pie chart, you can see the 67% of our funds come from the response fund, and we'll cover that at the end again. 25% is federal receipts. That's actually cost recovery for overseeing cleanup of federal contaminated sites. And then the other 8% is split between some other minor funding sources, designated general funds, interagency receipts, and unrestricted general funds, and we'll get into the detail on those as well. The bar charts then show the distribution of these funds within our programs within the division. So the director's office on the bar charts there is the first one on the left, is at 1%. The contaminated sites program is at 43%, and you'll notice that that's half federal. We get virtually half of our contaminated site work is contaminated sites associated with federal facilities. And so that's the reimbursement from the federal government for oversight of those cleanups. The third bar chart then is our industry group that oversees and regulates the industry. They have a bit of a mix of funding there, but they're primarily response fund. The fourth bar over then is our response program, and they're purely response fund funded. And then the last bar chart is our response fund group, which is a small group funded by the response fund.
Senator, if you have any questions at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Okay, turning to page six then, is another breakout on the pie chart of our budget detail. So this pie chart shows again the distribution of all funds by pie slice by program there. So once again, you can see the contaminated sites program has the bulk of the funds, about almost half of our budget is 43%. Our industry regulated program is at 26%. Our prevention and emergency response program is at about 22%. And then our response fund administration group is at 8%. This again is the number values for the funding sources that you can see here. Unrestricted general funds and total about $669,000. Designated general funds are about $415,000. The response fund is $13 million. That's our biggest funding source. Our other state funds, primarily interagency receipts, are $516,000. And then federal receipts are $4.8 million. So that's the breakout between funding sources. So that's the big picture, and then we'll dive into the program detail next if you have no questions on.
I've got questions.
Okay.
You ready?
You bet.
Second. So I go to page three. I have it's kind of an interesting situation. I'm going to say it's a hypothetical for now. So what happens have you ever come across a situation where you have land, you'll have state land that was owned by the state for many years, let's say dating back to the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and then all around it you have private parcels. But there was a suspect operation going on there. And there is a theory that the land is contaminated. As a result of that, the land may be in a great location, but there is concern that whoever picks that land up inherits the contamination and the cleanup. How And then again, I would add another thing. I'm not really sure where the contamination came from, whether it came from state land or the private land, because the private land may have been supporting the state operation. So how does that, how do you unravel a bailiwick such as that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that some of the contaminated sites we run into, particularly the historical one, which I refer to as legacy sites, and so those are sites that have been subjected to contamination well before the laws were even on the books, and now we're confronted with dealing with them and applying today's laws to them. So if you have a source that's a state land surrounded by private lots or private property, there's multiple ways to get at it. The first step usually would be to do what they call a preliminary assessment. And a preliminary assessment is a non-invasive investigation of documents, okay? So that's step one. So, and what they do in that, we call them archaeologists, if you will. They go back and they review the property records for all of the parcels.
Let me interject. What happens if you have private property owners that it's, they don't want to know? Because they're not sure, they think that there may be something under there, and it may have come from the state land, or it may have come from another private parcel onto all of their land.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't want to know, because they're not yet prepared to sell the land or do anything with it.
Right.
How do you deal with something like that? In other words, folklore states that there's something happened, there's contaminants there, but they don't want anyone messing with it, because if they do, they're afraid that something's going to happen.
Sure, and that is not uncommon. Well, first of all, for physical access to the property, we can't do that without a search warrant, so we would not go on the property. So if we otherwise had to, because of the other neighbors and whatever concerns were there, we would have to get as much information as we possibly can then from the publicly available records, which usually includes the property transaction records. So whatever's in the recorder's office would be free game, and we would look through that. That would then take you to prior property owners, which may then lead you to interviews. So if at one point there was a service station there or some other kind of operation, or a guy had a junkyard or whatever, so it's kind of a Columbo type. You work your way back to try to reconstruct the history of the uses of those properties to the best of your ability.
Is there a hold harmless or a statute of limitations that folks can find some relief or comfort? In other words, is there a, you know, let us know if there's something on there, we'll come in there, investigate it, mitigate it, we won't hold you responsible?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one of our priorities is reuse and redevelopment, which we'll cover when we get to the contaminated site section. So our priority is to get these sites back into reuse, and we have a pretty active, robust program to do that. So there are several tools and ways to approach that. First, we're a strict liability state, so anybody is potentially responsible. So you have to wade through, though, to identify who was actually culpable. Is usually the one that ends up then having to pay the bills, the one that actually caused the problem. So in the course of sorting that out, a lot of people, yeah, they probably unknowingly bought the property without knowing that the contamination was on it. Now, in this day and age, that's getting more difficult to do because there were some laws passed a couple years ago. You have to fill out a disclosure statement. I mean, if you go buy a lot right now, you have a disclosure form that you have to fill out. And one of the sections that was put into the law is a section you have to disclose any oil or hazardous substance, any knowledge you have of oil or hazardous substance property ever being on that property. And so in the modern day here, those disclosure forms that are required by law now force people to fess up, so to speak, if they have a problem. But there's a big, huge, the ones prior to that, that information would not necessarily have been disclosed. So you really had the situation historically where somebody would have innocently bought the property without knowing there was contamination. It could be another situation where nothing happened on the property at all, but there's a groundwater plume. See, it's coming from another source. And we have many investigations of the state that we call area-wide investigations. And an area-wide investigation is where you have contamination that goes underneath more than one parcel, and it's affecting another parcel. The biggest one we're dealing with right now, of course, you're probably aware of, is in Fairbanks with Flint Hills. We have over 250 water supplies impacted from the sulfur lake contamination. So what are the options for these people? So you sort through the record, and you try to reestablish as best you can as to what happened. Now, We have legal instruments that we promote for our reuse program. So if a guy that's selling this contaminated property in the middle, and let's say if he was the source but he doesn't have the money or something, we promote getting an assessment of the extent of contamination so you can estimate the cost to do the cleanup. And then we will execute an agreement then with the people that want to purchase it to hold them not liable. And so it tries to force a buyer or seller to agree on what the discounted price of the property would be so that the guy that buys it knowingly with what he's got to clean up. And if he's got the money, he can get a discounted price from the seller. The seller can be protected by this agreement, and so can the buyer. The buyer is committed to doing the cleanup then, and the seller gets the protection. They both get the immunity, so to speak, from the law as long as they move forward with the agreement. And that's one tool we have in the toolbox to be able to make those things move.
Okay, thank you. The only other question on page three I have is you have industry preparedness and emergency response. Is there duplication of services? Is there a duplication of activities, services?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The general line is the emergency response are all the new spills that are reported. We receive about 2,000 or so spill reports a year, and they're all immediately addressed by the emergency response group. And it's one of our performance measures is that that group immediately attack that spill, get the cleanup done, so that we do not have residual contamination that turns it into a long-term contaminated site. Generally speaking, 80% of our contaminated sites are petroleum hydrocarbon contamination. And so we try very hard when we do the initial response during the emergency phase to do a complete cleanup so that we don't add to the count, and we've been pretty successful at that. We're over 90% now. So for new spills, we're not adding to the backlog of contaminated sites. We're keeping them from becoming contaminated sites, but we're still dealing with the backlog of legacy sites and have a ways to go yet. The contaminated sites are much more complicated because, generally speaking, the split between the two is the contaminated sites are the subsurface. So they're the ones that get down on the ground. And there's limitations then on the technical and economic feasibility, digging that out. And then you've got groundwater issues, and it's very difficult then to get the detail on where these groundwater direction and flow and what other lots are impacting. They're slow. They're not those kinds of responses are not conducted under emergency conditions. They're under project management, because you have to be very careful about where you're going to drill a well to get a piece of information, because the well drilling is very expensive, and you got to maximize the amount of information you can get about that with as small a cost as you can.
So Director Dietrich, you have under industry preparedness and then under emergency response, prevent oil spills, and then under emergency response, you say prevent the effects of oil. I was just wondering if there's any redundancy.
No, Mr. Chairman, the other thing that the emergency response, I'll give you an example, like the Repsol had a gas well kick here a year ago, and it was a difficult winter cleanup. It was about a 2.5 month job, but it was on an ice island off the Colville River Delta, accessed by ice roads. And so we had to get her done before cleanup, because getting in there after cleanup is a problem. And you have to monitor then the restoration if there's any. So you have to get all the cleanup done, which includes brushing. We actually have a tundra treatment manual now that's been developed over the years. So we actually got really good techniques for cleaning up spills up north, and it's fairly businesslike now. So, but you got to get all that done to mitigate any impacts of any residue coming off and getting in the Colville River Delta and affecting wildlife then after breakup occurs. So we try to get that all done before breakup. It doesn't become a contaminated site, and no wildlife impacts. That's all.
One the last question for a little while. Page 7. You have on the right challenges, and then on the bottom, stamp standards.
Yeah.
Where are the standards?
The standards are in regulation. And we have a lot of contaminants. Part of the problem is there are, by orders of magnitude, more chemicals and contaminants out there than there are standards which are set, and that's why that is flagged as a challenge for us. The sulfalane, again, is an example. That's one for which there was no pre-existing drinking water standard or public health standard, and we had to go through CDC, ATSDR, and EPA to establish what was a protective level, because because existing standards and the research you need to develop an appropriate public health standard just doesn't exist. And we're running into more of those. The PFCs with fire training water now are showing up in Alaska. And so those are a challenge. We're otherwise not a standard-setting organization. We don't have the wherewithal. We have to go to the other state or federal agencies that have that capability.
Thanks. So where are we now?
Page 7. That's right, exactly where we're at, sir. So this is the beginning now of the contaminated site program, and I'll give you a quick thumbnail overview on this. They manage our contaminated sites. They manage the cleanup. We've got a key arm of it is reuse and redevelopment. All the box stores up there in Fairbanks, I don't know if you're familiar, Office East, used to be the pipeline, Alaska Pipeline Storage Yard. Those all had contamination. That's a good example of reuse. Got in there, took care of all those things, put some institutional controls on there, allowed those property transactions to go forth and get that property back into development.
Just an aside, I'm sorry, it's you, not me. You keep spurring these questions.
Yeah. No, go ahead. That's what I'm here for.
How do you deal with naturally occurring asbestos at a school site, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Very, very good question, sir. And fortunately for us, that's EPA regulated.
Okay.
So we get a,
What's EPA regulated?
EPA has asbestos regulation. We have not adopted that in a state level.
Okay, thank you.
So risk-based clean, anyhow, the reuse and development, yeah, important piece. We mentioned already a little bit about the area-wide cleanups where in Fairbanks we've got a number of plumes that we're tracking that are headed towards the river, and those are very long-term. The attenuation contaminants in the groundwater just takes a long time, so you got to keep an eye on them. Institutional controls are the things we use then to restrict the use of a property if you can't get it all cleaned up. And Arctic Surplus in Fairbanks left a bunch of contaminants, so they put a cap over it at PCBs, and it's fenced. So the cap and the fence then preclude then entry by people that would come in contact with the contaminants there. And so that is an example of an institution control then to ensure that nobody didn't get it cleaned up, but you're not going to let anybody be harmed by it because you're protecting it. Groundwater contamination, again, those are all tough situations. New contaminants, those are challenges. Moving on then to page 8. This will give you a big high-level view then of the total number of sites. The 23, the orange ones are the number of ones that are remaining open of the backlog. We've got about 4,600 in the inventory. And we've cleaned up a pretty good portion of now, and that's the mandate of this program is to continue that cleanup. Probably 90% of the contaminated sites in the state now are what we call legacy sites. 75% of our spills are to land and groundwater, and that contributes to the problem. 50% of our sites are federally owned, roughly, and that's split approximately 35% between military and 15% are civilian federal agencies. We have major programs with the federal government, the Defense Environmental Restoration Program, and the formerly used defense sites. And I think at the peak, we've gotten a very good share of cleanup dollars through DOD to take care of DOD contamination issues in Alaska. It's a robust program. It continues on. I don't know, the number might hear is maybe 50 to 60 million a year being brought in by the federal government. They get a lot of these cleanups done through the Corps, working with DOD. The legacy sites, some of the legacy sites are from Cold War military sites, okay, the White Alice, the Dew Line Systems, World War II on the Aleutians, leaky underground storage tanks.
How about nerve gas sitting at the bottom of lakes?
I don't. We've had reports of nerve gas. I'd have to ground truth that for you to see if we've had any.
I think they found it a few years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Run into all kinds of, there was one just recently about the nuclear designed batteries for military tracking on Burnt Mountain, which is a hilltop about halfway between Arctic Village and Fort Yukon. It was used for tracking, and back in Cold War days, they used a nuclear battery that's got strontium in it the fuel source to make these things work, so it could do part of the defense tracking. So there's a lot of unusual military situations. Nuclear test site out at Amchika, so they're still tracking that. We have eroding landfills. The big share of the sites, so from military and civilian facilities, really is fuel storage, transportation, and distribution systems. They cause 80% probably of our sites from that. Leaky underground storage tanks. There was a 10-year period to clean those up. The state at the beginning of that cleanup period had 7,000 underground storage tanks in the state. $43 million were used from the response fund through a grant loan program to small mom and pop operators that resulted in the removal of 6,000 of those tanks. We have less than 1,000 left in the state now, and of those 1,000, there's probably 500 or 600 or so that are in some kind of assessment, monitoring, or cleanup that actually leak and cause a contaminated site and have some kind of additional remediation going on. In addition, we've had logging activities, mining activities, seafood processing, power plants. We've got the oil wells, federal oil wells, and NPRA, 137 of those. So legacy sites, a lot going on there. And we're having, you know, fairly good luck, but there's a ways to go there to get caught up on those. Page 9, then, is just a schematic there quickly to show you kind of our approach to working with contaminated sites. I mean, you have a source, the guy over there on the right with the drum. And so you have some leakage that goes underground through groundwater, and it's picked up by a well and people can ingest it, or you might have transport by air through volatilization and people can inhale it or come in direct contact with it. And each of those, we call it a pathway. So if you can't get these underground sources cleaned up, what you can do is if you break the pathway so that nobody's exposed, then public health's protection is achieved. So we actually have a performance measure where we track the number of pathways we break in a year. So if it's technically or economically not feasible to get these things done, then we look at other ways to break these exposure pathways. And by doing so, there may be a restriction so that that pathway remains in place over the long term. But it's another way, though, of protecting the public health that can get the job done without, in those instances where you can't get the cleanup done. That's the general approach. Page 10, then, is a thumbnail of some of the accomplishments for the last fiscal year. These are reported in our budget documents, and so we just skimmed off some of the highlights. But we've done assessment, cleanup, or monitoring or closure at about 1,200 sites last fiscal year. We did risk reduction measures at about 154 sites. We've done site review and risk evaluations for 161 new sites. Kincaid Park is a recent example of a reuse in Anchorage. That was a long, difficult one. Had a lot of players in it, but it is now a soccer field. So in the end, the lead got cleaned up, and we're happy that that got put back into use. We got our groundwater problems are centered in the areas of state where groundwater is a high commodity, has a lot of value. And Fairbanks and North Pole area has very high quality, good groundwater, and that's people can punch a well there and get good groundwater. So those are difficult situations, is where groundwater is readily available, and it's great use by a lot of people. And if it gets contaminated, then that's those can be tough situations.
Can I ask you a question? Groundwater as opposed to well water?
Groundwater that can be used from which you can withdraw water in your well and use it for drinking.
And again, it's probably me. Well water versus groundwater. Groundwater, isn't that on the surface and below to a certain extent, and then well water is you're drawing it from a well.
Yeah, the groundwater would be, take the North Pole area. Generally speaking, the surface of the groundwater below surface grade is probably at about 10 feet, roughly. So it's a shallow groundwater, and so people can punch with a very shallow well right down into that with a well point and put the pump on it.
Can they drink that water?
Yes. And if it's private, not all groundwater aquifers are equal in their quality. So there is variations, but generally speaking, the aquifers up there are good. The Tananaw gravels produce are very high, very valuable water quality resource in other areas of the state. Or if you even go to the hills in Fairbanks, then just right around Fairbanks, those guys got to drill wells 400 feet deep they get low yield and they end up with arsenic.
Okay, that makes more sense because whenever I go to Burbanks and visit people and do business, their bathrooms are all orange and there's one of the big businesses is water tanks and paying buying water. Okay.
And iron.
Yeah.
And they don't have those city municipal systems outside Fairbanks because of the permafrost and stuff, so there's a lot of individual wells in that area. And Juneau here is mostly on city water supply now, and a lot of Anchorage is city water supply. Kenai probably is the next area of the state that's got the greatest number of individual wells. And,
so could I ask a question related to those individual wells in my district on the Kenai and groundwater?
Yes.
I have one of those legacy sites I'm sure you're aware of.
Yes.
So do you have, like, mapping that shows the wells around that particular site and whether they're contaminated? I mean, this is a huge topic in the community.
Yes.
You know this.
Yes.
I don't know what kind of data you have on any of those surrounding wells.
Yes, Senator Geisel, through the chair, we do have information on area, and if you're talking like in the Nikiski, there's different aquifers down there as well, but the one that we've been spending a lot of time on in the Nikiski area, yes, we do have maps.
Mm-hmm.
We do have the contaminated sites marked on them. We do have well locations. Our drinking water program has done what they call source water risk assessments, so all the public wells that are there, they draw teardrops around them, which is shows the area of the groundwater from which they draw to pump water, and then they locate within those teardrops sources of contamination, so you can lay over contaminated sites or pass reports of spills, and then try to pull that all together with information that comes from all of those sources about the groundwater, the depth it's at, and one of the challenges on the Kenai is the aquifer there isn't like the aquifer in North Pole where it's a shallow water contiguous covers a huge area. There's different aquifers at different levels that go in different directions, so it makes the analysis of whether or not this one over here is influencing this one a lot more complex and requires more data than to tease it out. But there's a fair amount of work being done on all of that right now, and we'd be glad to give you whatever information you need on that.
Okay, that'd be helpful at some point.
You have 12,005 sites up in the top of page 10. That have been cleaned up. Do you have like maps? Do you have, is that public knowledge where people can go and see that where there were sites and now they're all cleaned up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've gone to because of the land transaction, because it contaminates sites, it can potentially interfere with land transactions. We have I wouldn't say 100%, but we have virtually all the contaminated sites on our website. That you can access right now. You can look it up by name. There's a number of ways you can get into it, and it will show you the complete administrative record done for that site, what we have.
Thanks.
And beyond that, we do have maps and other tools, though, for some of these. So that's kind of the accomplishment list then for them for the year. On page 11, then, is there a couple of examples of some of the performance measures we use. The top one there, is our target. We try to restore 150 sites for use per year is our target, and that's the red line, and we just about hit it on 2012, and then you can see the history there back to 2007. So this is one of our ongoing performance measures. The lower measure then is these pathways, and what we try to do is break 700 pathways a year, and we keep count of that, and use that then to gauge the rate of public health protection.
Well, could I ask a question about that breaking the pathways? So I'm looking at the diagram on slide nine. Are you just saying that you identify the contamination in the water table and tell people to stop drawing off that water table? Or do you actually put a barrier in? Or is it all of the above?
It could be either one. It could be treatment at the tap. Potentially.
Okay.
It could be a restriction to not use the water because treatment may not work, and therefore you then would have to haul water, and that is the case in many places right now. Or you could treat the groundwater. Or if you do a real good job, if you can get the source of it and you can cut off the source, then there are vapor extraction systems, air sparging systems, where you can actually treat the contaminant in the groundwater.
Hmm.
So there's a variety of approaches. The groundwater treatment takes longer. So if you want something immediate, you got to probably go right to the tap.
Sure.
And do something. Because the other tools to break the pathway just take longer. Attenuation is just the dilution of the contaminant in the groundwater as it's spread across, and that can be very long term.
Is DEC following the fracking scenarios and pulling down south just to see if, in fact, the some of the worst case scenarios are actually true? If they're not, in other words, being prepared for the eventuality that we may be fracking more and more shales,
right.
Shales fracking. Is that being looked at all by your department or not yet?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We're not on that. I think we do. I think we do have one representative, but our Division of Water, when they come up, will be able to tell you that they have been looking at that. And Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission also runs the Underground Injection Control Program, so they've got an arm in it, and so does DNR. And there is a state work group that's been looking at that and studying that issue. Page 12, then, is just a wrap-up on the contaminated sites, the budget. So $8.3 million is the total budget for that component, and you can see the breakout there. There's no unrestricted general fund. Response fund is about $3.7 million, federal receipts is $4.5 million, and the other state funds there, which is money we receive through DMVA for doing some National Guard cleanups, is the $92.3. The federal receipt component of $4.5 million, the bulk of that, about $3.4 million, is for federal military sites. And we also have some brownfield sites, some core money in there, some leaky underground storage tank money, and a little bit of monitoring money for the Mchitka area. Page 13 is the second program. This is our industry preparedness and pipeline program. So these are the people that oversee the industries in Alaska that are regulated, and their responsibilities then include reviewing and approving their oil spill contingency plans, conducting spill drills and inspections. We have financial responsibility requirements for regulated industry to ensure they have financial resources to be able to respond to an incident. They certify our oil spill response contractors and have a best available technology requirement. Challenges here, we spent a lot of time since the 2006 spill, which kind of brought the whole aging infrastructure into focus, working with industry. We're the only jurisdiction that regulates flow lines, which are the lines that carry the oil, gas, water from the wellhead to the processing center. That's the most corrosive of the fluids. They're not regulated by the federal government. And we actually have regulations in place since about 2006 and been working carefully with industry now to monitor spills from pipelines. Pipelines make up about 80% of the oil, gas infrastructure. They're the areas where we've had the largest spills. And so they're the focus after having done more or less a risk assessment on the oil infrastructure. They become the target then for our prevention efforts to reduce spills. And it's been working. We're not out of the woods. It's a very dynamic situation. And so it'll be incumbent upon industry and the state to stay on top of the changing conditions so that we can make adjustments to corrosion monitoring programs, different condition monitoring that they do to keep spills from occurring. So there's a lot of effort going into that. They're looking at leading indicators. We're trying to reduce leak detection times. We're doing thorough root cause analysis. We're escalating activities and oversight based on spill occurrences that occur. The group also deals with blowout contingency plans, which is a whole unfolding issue for offshore drilling. Page 14, then, it's probably, I don't know if you can read it on yours, but there's a schematic on the left. It's just a schematic of the oil infrastructure in Alaska. So it shows the general flow from the wellhead through flow lines to a processing center, through a crude oil transmission pipelines and to the terminal, and that's the basic structure. Nothing new there. The schematic on the right then shows you the specific components of the oil gas infrastructure that are regulated. And that includes offshore wells in both the North Slope and Cook Inlet, onshore wells. It includes crude oil tankers, crude oil tank farms, production facilities, and refineries. And some of those numbers, if you can read them there, will give you an idea on the number of wells and facilities that are involved here. And this is all on the crude oil side of the business. The lower half of that document then is the non-crude, is the refined product side. So the downstream of the refinery then, we regulate the non-crude vessels and barges, the railroad, non-tank vessels, which are vessels over 400 gross tons, of which there are at any time in a given year some in the order of 400 to 500 coming in and out of the state. Our non-crude oil terminals are just the larger ones, and all of the underground storage tanks are now regulated, so we don't repeat the historical leaking underground storage tank picture. And the things that are not regulated are shown in the circle, so they're not part of the spill safety net yet.
Is your group that's part of the pesticide spraying that the railroad does?
No, sir. Mr. Chair, that's the environmental health section. So they, I think they're either the next or the one after this. So,
okay.
Industry prepared accomplishments. So this just gives you a flavor again of how the budget highlights from last fiscal year. Number of contingency plan actions they've taken, inspections, drills and exercises, storage tank repairs, underground storage tank inspections, engineering reviews, and we also had a pipeline leak detection technology conference to try to identify best available technology for leak detection. Leak detection is very difficult with flow lines with three-phase fluids, and so there's a lot of technology issues associated with corrosion and a lot of new things being looked at, not the least of which is the new corrosion lab at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Just another effort by industry, and we will also have a memorandum of them to try to develop the state of the art in this state to keep up on our infrastructure. Page 16 then is a couple of the performance measures we use for this program. We're a little shy. We try to hit inspect or drill 80% of our high-risk facilities and 20% of our low risks. We're a little shy on 80% the last year. We didn't get what we needed, and so we need to pick up the effort there. It's important to note that we do keep track of the spills from regulated versus unregulated facilities, and the spills from regulated facilities are less than 10% of the spills from non-regulated facilities in the state. So without a doubt, the regulated community performs much, much better in the state. They have capability as well. When spills happen these days, people respond, things get taken care of. It's not a big emotional thing. It's just a very business type approach now.
What's a give me an example of a non-regulated.
If you go back to page 15 in the circle, so above ground storage tanks, less than 10,000 barrels total. So all of our rural fuel tank farms are below our threshold. Our threshold for regulating fuel storage tanks is for non-crude is greater than 10,000 barrels. That's 420,000 gallons. So we don't get into the smaller ones, but there's a lot of them in less than 10,000 barrels. Those are not regulated. Home heating oil tanks, not regulated. Non-tank vessels less than 400 gross tons, not regulated.
There's an accident or an earthquake, and your home heating oil tank that's 500 gallons flips over and spills. What happens?
Right. Well, we try to work with home heating fuel tanks. We have a prevention program since they're not regulated. So we try to provide technical assistance to the owner to get her cleaned up is the basic approach.
Find the owner?
Not usually, no. I mean, in some cases, we might have to pursue cost recovery for our costs, but unless there was negligence or something involved, and I can't think of a case where that's... I mean, we will be at the home show in Juneau here next week, and we've got a website to try to show how people to design and install home heating oil tanks, so the snow ain't coming over and knocking them over, and dealing how you put the lines and stuff in. So it's all from a prevention perspective, and we're trying to increase the knowledge of homeowners to take care of these. And home heating fuel tanks, again, when you look at the state development here, a lot of our home buried home tanks went in the ground in the 70s and 80s when we were climbing. So like the valley here is 80s construction, T111 with a buried fuel tank. And so our fuel tank problems are where those locations of the state where they're on diesel. And so it's rural Alaska, it's the interior, and it's here. And so a lot of these tanks are all coming up on about 25 or 30 year life. And so we're trying to encourage people, and usually it comes to a head at a land, so somebody buys or sells, now you got this disclosure thing. So you got to put down, my tank was put in long, or if you had spillage or something, and that forces then people to take it. There's contractors that deal this, so it's getting better now. I mean, contractors will come in, will do the cleanup. They can haul off the contaminated thing, soil. You can land farm it. You can fertilize it. So there's ways to deal with it, and then you can also close out your tanks. So a lot of people are going above ground tanks now because they don't want the risk of the. Okay. Back to P17, I think, is where we're at. So this then is the preparedness budget, and they've got a little bit more variety in their budget. They've got a total budget of $5.0 million. Response fund is $3.2 million of that, and then they have this other mix. They get $304,000, which we get from EPA for the underground storage tank program to prevent spills from regulated underground storage tanks. The other state funds is our RSA for that we receive for oversight of the TAPS pipeline. And then the unrestricted general funds is for our North Slope risk assessment engineering reviews that we do, and legislature appropriated general funds to do that part of what we do. And I think that covers it for...
Yes, I'm sorry.
The
response fund then is the
$5
fund.
When you see response fund here, yes, you were referring to that, and that's what we'll do at the last session here. We'll go through that in detail. And that, but that is, the 5 cents a barrel.
Oh, 5 cents. Thank you. Pardon me. $5.
That was
okay.
Posted.
Yeah.
That's posted on Bellevue, right? Is that the one that came in after Exxon Valdez?
The first response fund in the state of Alaska was passed in 1976. It's called the Coastal Protection Fund. Mm-hmm. And it went through several cycles up to the one you probably recognize. You've probably heard of HB 470. The response fund used to be known in the legislature a lot as HB 470. Mm-hmm. It went through 76. There was a challenge to tanker fees that were being charged to pay for the program. That was a challenge in Chevron versus Hammond. It got thrown out. There was another version of the fund done then in the early 80s, and then the oil and hazardous fund, as it became to known, was passed in 1986 in HB 470, and it was frequently called the HB 470 fund. So that passed in 86. It was changed again then after the Exxon Valdez, and it was changed again in 95. And I'll go through that when we get to the response fund report and go through that evolution. So the response program then begins on page 18. So they do their emergency. They're the guys who, that conduct the responses, use the incident command system. They participate in drills and exercise. They go to both oil spills or hazmats. They do all the government oil spill response plans. We have 53 local spill response agreements with remote communities in Alaska, and they also handle DEC's role in disaster response coordination. So our challenges with them is, again, hazmat is a priority for us, hazmat response, enhancing local readiness, which we do through our response agreements, and then Arctic shipping and offshore oil and gas development is in recent years an increasing issue that we've been dealing with. On page 19, the schematic on the left is a schematic of a statewide hazmat response work group. We had to decide in 1997 as whether or not the state wanted to stand up a hazmat response team in this group. It would have required about 30 positions. It takes a 7-person team to do a entry into a hazardous situation with a what we call level A response with a fully encapsulated suit and an SCBA. The costs were pretty high, so we did not go down that route. We created an ad hoc group then to pull together the hazmat capabilities within the state, which at the time only include partial capability in the Anchorage and Fairbanks fire departments. And we build on that and developed an agreement whereby the hazmat capabilities of those two towns could go out of jurisdiction at the direction of the state on-scene coordinator, and we reimburse them. And it was a very difficult agreement to negotiate, but it's now in place. And it allows us to use local resources, send them anywhere in the state. And the difficult part of the agreement was working out all the workers' comp issues and liability issues. Because if you're a fireman in Fairbanks, you're restricted to your jurisdiction. You're not covered. And that was the challenge. And when we got over that hump and got the agreement in place, this whole hazmat thing just blossomed. And we've got 26 organizations now that meet on an ad hoc basis. And we standardize procedures, protocols, flyaway kits, capabilities. We do hazmat commodity flow studies. And I'm proud to announce that the guy that has been ramrodding this for us since 97, just week before last, at their last meeting, was recognized as the Hazardous Materials Professional of the Year. Mm-hmm. And they created an award for him that will be given annually now to the outstanding hazmat organization or person in the state. And he also got 2 round-trip tickets on the railroad because the railroad's part of the hazard. So we're real proud of that. The bottom line here is I think this state's probably got as good a hazmat capability because we've merged the civilian with the military. So we can deal with explosive biohazards, chemical warfare, or our most common civilian hazmats, which is ammonia and chlorine, which are at our remote seafood processing places where they use chlorine for disinfection and ammonia for refrigeration. And those are gas releases, and a lot of them are converted off of the compressed chlorine now to reduce that hazard. Okay, 20, their accomplishments are on page 20. Again, this is just to kind of characterize what they do on the number of responses, the number of spills reported last year. 23 of them were considered significant. They had 3 oil spill drills participate in the Alaska Shield Hazmat Symposium. We developed geographic response strategies. We have oil spill contingency plans for 10 regions in the state. And they we're doing vessel risk assessments for 4 of the 5 shipping regions in Alaska right now, which is pretty significant. Our biggest spill risk in the state are maritime incidents. They're the most difficult to respond to. And there's a risk assessment underway in Cook Inlet. We're doing one in the Aleutians. There's Coast Guard is sponsoring one at the Bering Straits for Arctic traffic. And we did a southeast vessel traffic study because of the Panamax ships coming in here with an enormous number of people now. Arctic offshore drilling and Arctic shipping is a key thing. We did participate on the U.S. delegation to the Arctic Council for the past year. And that effort has resulted in an 8-nation mutual aid agreement now between the 8 Arctic nations that is now being finalized and will be announced in May at the meeting of the Arctic Council ministers. And so Alaska and the USN will be part of that Arctic response mutual aid effort.
Does your division have anything to do with any dealing with the tsunami debris that's coming our way?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do, and it's split. The official coordinator for the state is in the Environmental Health Division under the Solid Waste Program, and then we have a representative that works on her work group, and we take care of the oil hazmat. So any oil hazmats that roll up on the beaches that get found, they call us, and we work with the Coast Guard, and we'll take care of that aspect of it, and then they deal with the inert solid waste. And they, a fairly robust program. She'll give you a full report when she appears before you here.
This is somewhat an unprecedented event, and Alaska may end up getting the bulk of this debris. If that's the case, and it's somewhat overwhelming, is there talk about recourse through world court, whatever, to recoup damages from Japan for some of this stuff for Alaska?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm not up on all the details on that, but I do know that Japan has offered, I think, to the U.S. like $5 million. And I think it's at the Washington D.C. level now, and will ultimately go to NOAA, who is the federal coordinator for all the tsunami debris efforts, and are doing a pretty good job. So again, EH will be able to give you the specifics on that. But my understanding is that money then would be distributed from whoever gets the check in Washington D.C. back down through NOAA, who then works with the states.
I would imagine $5 million is not going to be able to cover all the debris. So Alaska, is it going to be Alaskans that fit the bill, or will, do you know if the federal government will come in and the federal government will go after Japan, or you know, we don't have to get into too detail here, but
right.
I guess my concern is Alaska going to pay for something that they had absolutely no involvement in?
Right.
You don't know yet?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I don't know how that will play out yet myself.
Okay. No problem.
Page 21 then is... again, the performance measures in for this program, we use a couple of them. That upper one is where we try to prevent the contaminated sites long-term cleanup. So we try to get 100% cleanup without long-term remediation. That's our goal when we respond to a new spill. And our other target down below here is to get them done so we don't even have to monitor them. And so it's all about a rapid response, media containment, and a thorough cleanup to the best of everybody's ability. Yeah, that prevents a lot of long-term costs and headaches. Their budget, which is on page 22 then, is all from the response fund, and they get $4.3 million. The last program is a small one. The response fund administration on page 23, they do our cost recovery, our contract management. They run the finance section of the incident command system when we have a larger event. We do biannual response fund reports that are submitted to the legislature by statute every 2 years, or one submitted in January that details all of our expenditures and revenues. They manage our IT, our RSAs, and our contracts. And on page 24, highlights from their accomplishments, and about 1,700 responsible parties billed for $2.7 million in 2012. We issued 54 notices to proceed for $4.2 million in state contracts for assessment and cleanup. We've got a stable of about 30 term contractors in Alaska that we use to do the cleanups. Alaska's got I think it was once valued by Alaska Business World, the cleanup sector in Alaska, the industry, at about $250 million. So we're very fortunate. We have got a lot of good expertise up here to do this kind of work. It's turned into a good, viable industry that we are totally dependent on to get the work done. And we had about $6.4 million in funding associated with 21 different federal grants. Their measures shown on page 25. Again, the top one is we try to get 80% billed and recovered in a year. There's always a time lag between the time you bill and the time you get the money back. Some of our cost recoveries go to litigation, and so the BP settlement was just deposited, as you know, and that was from 2006. So some of these, we had an anomaly here, you can see, in 2009 and 2012, and that's because we incur the cost 1 year, but we don't get the recovery till later years. And the 2009 anomaly was due to Drift River, Yukon flooding. We had some legal costs from the pipeline spills. And then the 2012 anomaly, where we didn't hit our target, was the Repsol shallow gas hasn't been wrapped up yet. We got some issues in Aniak, and part of that is the Flint Hills. We're hopeful we'll get those recoveries. It just won't be in the year in which they occurred. The second graph then is our target is 100%. So every time we have a recoverable cost, we have to document it to be able to get the recovery. And our target there is absolute. We want to make sure we document every one so we can get our money returned to the fund. Page 26 then is, again, their budget, $1.5 million. And you can see that's all pretty much all response fund. We get a few federal receipts there for a cleanup. And the bulk of the 1.4 in this unit then is used for RSAs with other agencies that participate in the state spill response system. So, Mr. Chairman, that closes the budget and component structure. So the next thing is about the response fund, starting on page 27, if you want to just roll into that.
Let's roll into that.
Okay. I think maybe the easiest way to do it is get that one-page graph out. That's, I think, the best way. There's a, it's on page 28 in the slide, but I think there may have been a 8.5 by 11 separate.
So as we go through this.
Yes, that's it, ma'am.
The result of the decreasing oil through the pipeline affects this fund, correct?
Correct.
So we're suspending it? Is that what I read?
Yeah. Well, here, if you go, if you got that graph there, I'll show you how this, it's kind of a, the fund has a lot of mechanisms and it's fairly intricate, and the statutory language behind it is that they put all the mechanisms and intricacies in it because it was intended to be self-sustaining. That was the theory behind it. That's in the statutory language. So if you look at this, you'll see a red line down the middle. There's actually six accounts in the fund, okay? So there's three accounts on the left side of the red line, and there's three accounts on the right side of the red line. So I'll talk about the left side first, and you'll see at the top there it says response. And on the right side it says prevention. The left side, which we'll go through now, is the $50 million, okay? And so what happens here, the first arrow you see under response is a 1 cent arrow. That's 1 cent that's collected from every barrel of crude oil produced when the balance in the response account is below 50 million. So there's an automatic mechanism in the response account that says when the balance is 50 million, the tax shall not be imposed. So the 1 cent shuts off. When the balance goes below 50 million, then the 1 cent automatically turns back on. And this is calculated by the Department of Administration on a quarterly basis. The 1 cent surcharge is currently turned off, and the balance is above 50 million. It's, I don't know, it might be 51 million or something like that right now. So that's deposited into a surcharge account. Then there's a second account in the green box that says response mitigation account. That's a separate account. That account is the account where we recover money that we spend from this response account, goes into that bucket. You all then appropriate from those two accounts with the yellow arrows through the appropriation process into the response account down below. And that's the $50 million account. So what happens is the surcharge account accumulates a 1 cent surcharge over the course of a year. The mitigation account accumulates all our recoveries over the course of the year. And then at budget time, the balances in those accounts are appropriated by the legislature down into the bottom account, the response account, which is the $50 million account. That account can only be accessed by the department for an imminent and substantial threat. So it's only for big events. It's not used otherwise to support our operational budget. Now going to the right side, it's the same structure. The prevention account side is intended as the funding source for our program. So when you see response fund listed in the budget documents here, they're talking about the prevention account. So once again, at the top, you have the 4 cent surcharge is on all the time based on crude oil production. It goes into the surcharge account and accumulates over the course of a fiscal year. The second account in the middle then, the prevention mitigation account, all the cost recovery that we do from our regular operational spills goes into that account along with fines, penalties, and settlements. And it accumulates over the course of a fiscal year. And then the legislature, through those yellow arrows, through the appropriation process, the balance in those accounts is transferred then into the purple account at the bottom, the prevention account. That's the one that's running out of money. That's our funding source. We can't take money out of the surcharge accounts or the mitigation accounts. So when you see response fund in these budget documents here, the account from which our funding has come is that prevention account. And the prevention account, the surcharge was, after the Exxon Valdez, they created a single account. And there wasn't two accounts, there was one account. And it was to be used for big spills and all the operational costs. And they estimated at that time, the legislature passed about 15 spill bills or so after the Exxon Valdez. And so they created a single account that was fueled by a nickel a barrel surcharge. And the nickel a barrel surcharge, based on the production estimates at that time, was to be the sustained funding mechanism for the state's spill prevention response programs. The nickel a barrel was in place in 90. The flows were up. And then in 95, a change was made. In 95, they went from the single account, which was being fed continuously by a nickel a barrel, and it was split into this, into two accounts. So the nickel, it was originally split into a 3 cent, 2 cent. And when they did that and they created that account, that was essentially a 40% reduction then in our funding source. And that created the underlying structural problem. And we've been fighting it ever since 95. And the other thing they did then, the money that had accrued in the single account when they passed the law in 95 and created two accounts, they split the money that was in the single account between the response account, and then they put some into the prevention account. So that prevention account, they put $47 million into the response account. The tax turned on, it rapidly hit $50 million, it shut off, stayed there forever. Stayed shut off until really 2006, I think. And then the prevention account got the other balance, and that created a temporary surplus. So we had more than what we needed were spending at that time. But since the revenue stream was no longer enough to sustain us, the governor did not sign the bill, pass the bill at the time, because he knew it wasn't enough for the long term. And they also, at that time, then decided to use a response fund for the underground storage tank grant load program, from which ultimately $43 million was spent in the cleanup tanks. So that the point here is that created our structural underfunding. And so ever since then, we've been reducing expenditures, watching everything very carefully, and trying to manage a balance of that account to cover what is otherwise annually a deficit spending situation for us. And so what you hear every year is, every year we project to see when that goes to zero. And so for this year, the projection is we're good for FY14, but it's projected to go to zero in 15. And on page 29 is that projection then, the next page in your slide presentation.
A lot of graphs recently seem to be going down like that with regard to oil.
Yeah, I mean,
observation.
This one is the way they when legislature all set it up. I mean, it's interesting. It's we're on a price per barrel, not we're not on what the rest of the general fund is on, which is they're on price per barrel. We're on barrels per day. Mm-hmm. So a $100 increase for price per barrel doesn't change our situation, because we're strictly on a production flow, and that's gone down. So in addition to the problem in 95, the structural issue we have, then on top of that, production continued to go on. And so every year, we're tighter and tighter.
Whether oil is a nickel a barrel or $1,000 a barrel, you still get your nickel.
Yeah, well, right now it's 4 cents. It was originally in 95, was 3.2, and then in 2000, what was it? Shortly thereafter, then they changed it to 1.4, and we're at 1.4 right now.
Let's keep going. We're almost done.
Page 29, then, is simply the shows the decline, and it shows that we're good for 14, and 15 we will run out. And the graph on page 30 just is shows the assumptions are used in those projections. We have multiple revenue streams. One is the surcharge. Another is our cost recovery fines and penalties, and another is our investment income. So another one of the unique features of the fund that they build in was that the interest off the principal in these accounts, which is $50 million, is invested by Treasury into Givenchy funds. And then the returns from that go back into here. That was another one that they make it whole. And that interest income has been as high as $7 million for us in some years, and it's now probably less than $1 million. So those kind of multi-million dollar fluctuations in revenue streams that we have no control over are what makes it makes things exciting. And this just details it. It shows the assumptions that we're using $1.2 million a year for investment income and $1.5 for fines and recoveries. And in FY14, you see it at 11, and that's because of the BP settlement. That's why that one was higher.
Do you find do you find the fine concept, do you feel the fine concept actually prevents, I don't know how to word it, some would say it's accident, some would say it's deliberate spillage, et cetera. Do the fines, do you feel the fine concept prevents that, helps lower that incident rate? Is there any view on that? Or is it simply a way to collect money? What's the motivation behind the fine?
Cases that have significant fines attached to them are the exception to the rule. In most cases, the cost recovery owed the state, in and of itself can be a significant number. And by far and away, the majority of the cases we bring forth, 99%, some pretty high number, are civil. There's very few that are criminal. And the civil ones allow for us to recover for state costs and what they call economic savings. And economic savings under the our civil penalties are not designed to be punitive. They're designed to be compensatory. And so our whole structure, if you just look at the civil side, really doesn't include a fine in the true sense of the word. They're designed for economic savings and for state costs. And economic savings, one Department of Law calculates, is what a person save by shortcutting something and not doing it that resulted in the spill. And if the Department of Law can establish what that is, then that becomes part of it, and that's the compensation to the state. So the state can also recover them for damage to resources. And again, that's compensatory. So the compensatory fines are more substantial than the criminal fines in terms of dollar.
So
can be, I should say.
So I have a question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. So this 4 cents, I mean, I'm just looking at this and going, wait a second. We've had inflation. Should this 4 cents be adjusted for CPI? I mean, it's not, clearly not covering your costs anymore. Is that a solution to this? What do you see as a solution?
We've had legislative intent letters
mm-hmm.
in 2010 and 2011 and 2012 each year requesting what are the options, and we can do just your question. And so we have a response on record from OMB as to how
okay.
to fix the hole. And their plan is we calculate these projections annually, determine the deficit, and OMB is in proposing then to backfill the deficit with GF.
Okay.
So for 14, there's no deficit. So there's no issue for 14.
Mm-hmm.
The prevention account will cover it. And then 15, we've been doing this annually for more than a decade, just doing the projections each year to see where we're at. And we'll do it again then for 15. And there is a response on file from OMB just this year to mm-hmm. Senator Lisa McGuire,
uh-huh.
who asked the very same question last year, and we can make that available to you.
Please.
Okay. Why can't this number be raised and then executed the way the 1 cent is? If the program doesn't need the money, then you suspend it or reduce it. I mean, this just seems crazy every year to, well, okay, never mind. It's a bigger problem then. Okay.
Well, through the chair, sir, I mean, the 1 cent is automatically written in the statute in terms of how it comes on and off. It's on a you calculate the quarterly balance. If the balance is below, Department Administration makes that determination. They tell revenue, tax goes back on.
Yeah.
It's not recomputed then for another 3 months, so it's done on a quarterly basis. And each time they make the decision, if it's above 50, it goes on. And it doesn't go on then until the end of that next quarter. So
right.
There's a lag time. But, yeah.
Okay.
So there's, okay.
I can only tell you how it works.
I'm trying to figure out how to make it work better. Sounds like
it's an automatic lever as a result of legislative action,
mm-hmm.
but does it have to be annually legislatively appropriated into that fund?
The funds that, if you look at the diagram again on page 28, so the appropriation includes appropriation from the surcharge account and the mitigation accounts into the response account. So that's the appropriation step that's done. So the money that accumulates over the course of a fiscal year in the surcharge account and the mitigation accounts then is subject to legislative appropriation into the big account.
Okay, so it's not you, it's me. So through legislation, this fund and mechanism to fund it was developed, which is automatic. It was automatic, and it's still sort of automatic, in which every barrel, X amount, a penny, 4 cents, whatever, 3 cents, 2 cents, is taken off of what, though? What is it taken off of?
Each barrel of crude oil production.
It's not a tax per se on the oil company. Is it taken out of our GF? Is it just the mechanism to earmark money?
It's called in the statute. It's called a surcharge. Is the label, and it's the counting of the barrels is by revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the accounting is by administration. So they report the number of barrels produced.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some nuances here that I don't fully understand that revenue and administration does, but there's taxable barrels.
Right.
There's
mm-hmm.
certain taxable barrels. So there's some barrels that I can't explain myself, though, that are not computed, but it's a fairly small amount.
Must be the royalty barrels.
It
but
could be.
What I'm trying to find out is, could a mechanism, I'm just asking, is this a mechanism that
mm-hmm.
has to be annually Does there have to be annual legislative action, or theoretically, could one set up an endowment program like this based upon the number of barrels that just goes automatically in?
No, that's when this account was first designed, when it created a department, it was to deal with providing environmental protection for a state that was getting a resource development. So they put the tax on in there, and the first thing they found out is the constitutional prohibition on dedicated accounts. Right?
Oh, right, sure.
And that's why this is the way it is. That's why you've got these two accounts above here,
mm-hmm.
because they can't put it directly into account without you guys appropriating it.
We appropriate every year?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sure.
You have to appropriate from those two accounts every year, because otherwise it is considered a dedicated fund, and that's not constitutional.
That's a good question. Thank you. Well,
okay.
There we go. Any more questions?
You hung in there.
Well, thank you very much, sir. And I have a note here then. We need to get some information on the Kenai area.
That would be awesome.
To confirm with you on the follow-ups here.
Sure, that'd be great.
And are there other things then?
No, I didn't even ask if we could still use a Subaru chassis for septics up in the valley.
Good question, though. But how about that OMB letter, too?
Yes.
A copy of that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator, anything else?
Nothing for me.
We're adjourned until the next meeting, Tuesday, March 5th at 5 o'clock. Senator Finance. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to give this back to the fine individual that loaned that out.
Down there.
I don't know if it was a cartoon show or where this came from, but my daughter used to say these boring stories are so interesting. They are.
I'm going to roll, Sheila, in many different directions.
Sorry, I was a little bit late. I was with the Coast Guard.
Well, that's okay.
Marine transportation issues.